folks. Josh here.
And Jen.
And this is From Cloud to Cab. Today we're talking about a few updates with the University of Delaware Extension. And we had Jen interviewed a few extension agents by phone. By the way, all these podcasts, Jen came up with all the topics for them. I'm not going to take credit for any of it. I'm just here to talk, essentially. But let's Jen, where'd you get the idea for this one? And why do you think it's important that farmers in the region get updates from this important agency?
One of the farmers that I had talked to initially about doing a podcast series in general talked about how when he was on a green board, he was familiar with a lot of the projects that they funded. But being off the board, that he didn't have access to the same information. And so I work with these guys at the University of Delaware. I'm going to talk to Mark Van Gessel, Bill Sissel, and David Owens. And they were willing to sit down with me to go over some of the projects that they have that are currently funded and underway this year, and some of the results that they've seen from recent projects, including one that I work with them specifically is the Delaware Cover Crop Network. And so even though this is coming out when we're not necessarily having cover crops so much on our mind, we'll talk about why that project is still relevant right now in this early season, and some of the other things that they're working on too.
Sounds good. All right, guys, let's do the show.
This is Jen Nelson. In this episode of From the Cloud to the Cab, I caught up with extension specialists from the University of Delaware to talk about some of their current projects. Now, these conversations were recorded on May 17th and 18th when Delmarva was in the middle of a pretty significant rain spell. I talked to Mark Van Gessel, who's a weed science extension specialist in Georgetown, and David Owens, who's an extension entomologist in Georgetown, and Bill Sissel, who's an extension agent in integrated pest management up in Middletown. I spoke first with Mark Van Gessel, and we started out by talking about some of the questions that he's received from growers in recent days.
Phone calls and questions are being asked right now are around burn down herbicides that didn't control everything they expected them to control. So they're, someone was just asking about vetch, and they didn't use an effective herbicide to control the vetch before they planted their soybeans. So now the soybeans are up and they have vetch in the field. What can they use to control that vetch? Questions about, they've got the soybeans planted, they got them in, just as it was starting to rain, and they don't have their pre-emergence herbicides applied, and, what is going to be safe to apply to these soybeans as they're cracking through or right after they crack through to get the residual control that they need. Some of the questions about replanting. There has been a couple of fields that had to be replanted, and particularly corn. And the corn is small. It's Roundup ready corn, so they can't use Roundup to kill it. How can they kill corn so they can go back and replant? So those are some of the questions that been asked, in the last day or so.
Gotcha. And so what kind of advice have people been getting? Are they out of luck or are there options for right now?
So there's some options. Part of part of the issue is some of these are situations where we run across very infrequently. So where we don't have ready answers for a lot of these. And so we're trying to piece together information based on things similar to this that we might have done or other scenarios that might transfer to it. But you know, that we don't have a ready answer as to this is going to be the best option for you to go with, or more importantly, if is how well this is going to work. You know, this may be the best option we can come up with at this time, but I'm not sure whether that's going to give you 90% control or 70% control. You know, we just don't know. And the other challenging thing is, you know, they're calling. They looked at their fields this morning, and it may be Monday by the time they get back into the field. So what, you know, things are going to be progressing along. I mean, corn with this plenty of moisture and cool weather is just really moving along pretty quickly. And so what might be, you know, two-color corn now is definitely going to be another collar or maybe even taller by the time they get into spray. Likewise, the weeds are going to be that much taller. So, you know, looking at it now and trying to give information for what it might be in even 4 or 5 days is a little challenging. I think one thing that has come up repeatedly is poor performance of burn down herbicides. So, you know, they're going to plant no-till and they went out and sprayed and now the field isn't all brown like it should be. There's still green tissue out there, you know, and number one, why did that happen? And then what can they do about it? And, you know, as long as the crop is not planted, then it has a lot more flexibility. If the crop is planted, choices become narrower. And if the crop is planted and out of the ground, it becomes even more challenging in some of these situations.
So what did happen with the failure for the herbicide, you know, where it wasn't controlling or the poor performance? What happened there?
Yeah, I think part was what usually happens is the rates weren't, they didn't use high enough rate. And our weather has been so up and down with, you know, temperatures going from 90s down to 50s and 60s, and nighttime temperatures even get lower than that. It's been all over the board. And so a lot of these weeds were not as actively growing as they usually are that time of year. And I think so the inconsistent weather coupled with maybe inadequate herbicide rates, or in some cases, you know, there was a few species out there that maybe the grower didn't see when they chose their herbicide. And, you know, and so the herbicide combination that they had didn't control everything that, you know, wasn't designed, I guess, to control every species in the field. And so those things are starting to green up again. So a combination of factors as to why some of these fields are not as clean as they should be.
Well, so what are some of the projects that you're working on this year?
We're continuing our herbicide evaluation projects, which is, you know, trying to look at as many of the commercial products as available and trying to look at different combinations and different weed species just to get a little bit better handle on consistency of performance of a lot of these products. We're doing a fair amount of work this year with the dicamba soybeans. We've been limited in the past as to how much research we can do with them because they were considered regulated genetics up until recently. So now, you know, we're able to put them in some different fields that we couldn't put them in the past because of having to have certain buffers around the fields. So it allows us to look at them under some different situations that we haven't looked at. And looking at how the dicamba soybeans can help with some of our herbicide-resistant species like the mare's tail, common ragweed, and Palmer amaranth in particular. We've got some trials looking at different approaches for weed control in both corn and soybeans, looking at different different sort of strategies, timing of burn down application followed by what in-crop herbicides and what timing of those in-crop herbicide applications are going to be most effective. We've got some projects going on this year with strip-till. We were able to borrow a strip-till unit, so for the first time, we've been able to look at strip-till weed control and just corn production under strip-till conditions. So we're excited about that. And we're continuing a number of our cover crop trials, looking at cover crops for weed control.
So with the dicamba soybeans, they're dicamba ready, like Roundup ready soybeans or Roundup ready? Do I understand that right?
That's correct. That's correct. So they can withstand the dicamba herbicide and, you know, and have basically no effect on it. Without that gene in there, dicamba at really low rates would kill soybeans. But these are able to tolerate the dicamba herbicide. And all the soybean varieties that have dicamba resistance also have glyphosate resistance in it. So it's resistant to both glyphosate and dicamba herbicides.
So you can have more of a multi-action herbicide program to help out with weeds? Is that the idea?
That's the idea, yes. Yep. And being able to use a herbicide that typically we haven't used in soybeans in the past. So, you know, until recently, we've only used dicamba on grass crops, corn, small grains, pastures. But we've always used it as to control broadleaf crops, or excuse me, broadleaf weeds. But now we're able to use it in a broadleaf crop to kill broadleaf weeds. And so it's a new active ingredient that we haven't had in the past.
Now, dicamba is getting a lot of attention for issues with drift. Is that right?
That's correct.
So there's guidance for how to control that, how to work with that so that it can still be used as an effective herbicide. But,
yes.
You know, being a friendly neighbor and all that good stuff.
That's right. I mean, so what we are focusing on here primarily is effectiveness. How effective is dicamba to control a lot of these weeds? Because in reality, we haven't looked at dicamba at, so the use of dicamba in soybeans is different than what it's been in corn for a long time.
Okay.
So while dicamba's been labeled in corn, typically farmers are using it at lower rates when they're using it in corn, and often using it in combination with other herbicides. So in some ways, it's very different the way we're trying to use it in soybeans. We're using higher rates, and we're not always using it with other post-emergence herbicides. So we're looking at it mostly from the standpoint of how effective is it going to be on things like Palmer amaranth, common ragweed, some of these herbicide-resistant weeds that we have. But there's the other issue of off-target movement. And we have a few projects, not a lot this year, because we're just not really set up to look at off-target movement of dicamba. Most of that work needs to be done on some very large acreage with commercial size equipment to really see how effective these strategies are at reducing drift and potentially volatility. You know, as of right now, there are a lot of restrictions on application to keep it from moving off target. Height of the boom, the wind speed and wind direction, maintaining buffers, limiting what sort of tank mixes you can use with dicamba, whether you need a drift retardant to go with it. There's lots of things that have been put on the label as part of being a restricted use herbicide now to mitigate this off-target movement. And, you know, with our diverse agriculture here and the close proximity of residential areas to ag fields, it's something that we need to develop a better feel for, you know, where it is appropriate to use dicamba and where it's not appropriate.
Makes sense. I know we didn't want to focus too much on cover crops, but I have noticed this spring a lot of cover crops being allowed, like a lot of later termination, that there was a lot of stuff that, you know, either because of weather or because of choice, you know, was left in the field and terminated much later than I've typically seen. So I wondered if you've received questions on that or if people have had issues with burn down and emergence of these, of all this biomass that's out there.
No, I haven't gotten too many questions about that yet. Okay. And you know, likewise, I have seen a lot of it, you know, a lot of cover crop fields that haven't been burned down. And like you say, whether that was done intentionally or whether, you know, the Mother Nature forced them to that. Mm-hmm. You know, a week ago, we were concerned about, you know, these cover crops that had not been terminated yet, how much soil moisture they were using, you know, whether right. there would be, a, you know, good soil moisture for planting, and whether folks looked at that and thought, yeah, I'm going to wait for a good rain so I can replenish the soil or to make sure that that cover crop is actively growing and the glyphosate or whatever method I'm using to kill it is going to be effective.
I feel like we've got the soil moisture covered now.
I think we do. And and when they go in and kill the cover crop, it won't be under stress. And so now one of the things about the cover crop, you know, with like I say, we've got a lot of biomass. You know, if you've looked at some of these fields, and I'm sure you have, just how much more biomass there is now than there was a week to 10 days ago.
Right.
And you know, we talk a lot about, farmers are hearing about, you know, timely planting to get maximum biomass, but boy, you can really make up for some delayed plantings by delaying your termination in the spring. So, one of the things about that, and in fact, I'll probably write an article for the weekly crop update, is, you know, if you're going to go ahead and terminate your cover crop, be sure you give it time for it to completely desiccate before you plant into it, because that cover crop that's been sprayed but not completely dead can be tough to plant into. In general, I usually tell folks either plant it while the cover crop is green or plant it when it's brown. But that in-between stage sometimes can be tough to get the planter through and for the cultures to slice through those stems like they should.
That's where it's going to give you a lot of trouble.
Yeah. That's where you tend to get that hairpinning where, you know, like the rye stems will get pushed down into the seed's furrow but not totally sliced through.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, and that'll be kind of an interesting thing. Hopefully we have a chance to follow up after the season is well underway, you know, to see how that worked out with everybody's experience who delayed termination, you know, just to see if it was a benefit to the next crop or if it made for challenges with this early season growth and development. So,
yeah, and whether they thought that the, you know, challenges were outweighed by the benefits of having the more cover crop there. It'll be interesting to see.
Yep.
Next, Mark and I talked about a project that we're working on together that's funded by Northeast SAIR. It's a partnership with the University of Delaware and Delaware State University and other partners called the Delaware Cover Crop Network, which is a series of four sites throughout the state that were planted into cover crops in fall of 2017 in different species and planting rates, seeding rates, and planting dates that visitors could visit and look at throughout the fall and into the spring and even into the early growing season to see how those different cover crops affected the early growth and development of the next crop. So we go over some of the observations that we had seen and some of our plans for the early season.
I'll put in a plug for the demonstration sites that we have at the Carville Research and Education Center and in Middletown at the Marl Pit Road site, that while the cover crops have all been terminated, it'll be a nice opportunity, timing-wise, to get out and see the effect of that cover crop on the soybeans that are going to be planted at those sites, and to see how the soybeans are responding to these cover crops, the different species that we had planted, the different timings and ratios of cover crops that were planted.
And I was thinking that it would be good to take pictures. We've taken pictures all through the fall and the spring, and I knew that I was going to get out and take another set of pictures of the early cash crop following these cover crop plots that we have out there, but it'll be nice to come back maybe another month later to see, you know, if there's unevenness in the early season, what that continues to look like, what that progresses over into the season a little bit. So
Right. I'll mention that to Bill and see if he'd be able to do some stand counts up there. Now, Middletown has not been planted. They sprayed it last week, but it has not been planted yet. And as soon as it dries out, we're going to spray down here in Georgetown. And I was going to have the guys take another set of pictures before it gets sprayed.
Okay.
Austrian winter peas have really come on in some of these plots. And so get one sort of late set of pictures, but then doing some stand counts once the soybeans get up and see if there's any difference in stand.
I think I was out there last week and I had taken some, but I mean, you know, it could even be different now versus what it was last week, but I know I had to move cover crops out of the way so that you could see the signs, especially on a lot of those early plots. Like, you can still see the difference between the early planted plots and which were, I think, September, and then the middle planted plots were October, and then in November we had the late planting. You can see even now the difference in biomass between those early and middle and late planted plots.
That
struck me because the November plots, that's still getting into like a typical cover crop planting time for a lot of those grass species. So it was striking.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. It'll be, you know, the other thing that I've thought about sometimes too with the growth there was, remember I did not burn down the sorghum Sudan grass. And so we had some early season, shortly after the September planting dates, that sorghum Sudan grass came back. And you know, that probably slowed down some of the growth of the those cover crops last fall. And
that
I'm wondering
was frost-killed.
Right. So I'm wondering if there may not have even been more differences had we not had that sorghum stand grass there in the fall.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
I don't know. I just kind of wonder. But you know, at this point, it's definitely not going to happen this week, the planting or the spraying there. But we'll get another set of pictures just before they spray. So that'll be at least a week to 10 days from the set of pictures you had.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot going on right now, you know, with the heat, with the, well, the growing degree days and the weather that we've had. You know, there's been a lot of change in just the past few weeks. So I'm glad we're capturing as much as we are.
Yeah, right, right. I think that'd be kind of striking, some of those photographs of, mm-hmm. you know, April, early May, mid-May, in terms of biomass production.
I think it gives a lot of people information in terms of making decisions for when they want to terminate, like how much biomass are they comfortable with versus how long you have to leave it in the field, at least with the conditions that we had this spring, to achieve what you're looking for.
Right, right. Yeah. And for someone who doesn't want to deal with the biomass, how quickly can get ahead of them if they don't stay on top of it.
That's right. Yep.
All right.
Mark, thank you very much for taking time out this morning.
No problem. No problem, Jen. And we'll talk to you soon.
Next, I caught up with David Owens, extension entomologist for the University of Delaware in Georgetown, and Bill Sissel, extension agent for integrated pest management up in Middletown, where we talk about some of their current projects for this year.
My name is Bill Sissel. I'm also with the University of Delaware. I work as an extension agent in integrated pest management, IPM. The program I work on focuses largely on insect management of vegetable and field crops. Some of what we do is insecticide efficacy trials, looking at different ways as well to manage insect pests, and not just insects, but also slugs. So really anything that feeds on crops is something that we're interested in working on.
I'm David Owens. I am the Extension Entomology Specialist for University of Delaware. I am housed at the Carville Center in Georgetown. I recently joined UD back in the fall of 2017. And part of my job is to interface with my counterparts from other states to keep up to date with migratory pest populations as they move through the system, provide management recommendations to growers who have questions, and also in conjunction with Bill Sissel, we conduct a lot of efficacy trials so that we can base those recommendations on Delaware-specific data. This year, we're conducting a variety of pest population surveys and beneficial insect surveys, as well as continuing to maintain UD's famed insect trapping network, looking for corn earworm, European corn borer, stink bugs, true armyworm, and western bean cutworm throughout the state.
So what kind of projects do you have going on in the field this year?
Well, this year we are doing several surveys. One of them has been funded by the Delaware Soybean Board, surveying soybean crops from cover crop termination until harvest, looking at insect populations. And this is to give growers a kind of a snapshot of what's moving through the fields, as well as deliver them timely information on pest management. We're also looking at sorghum. Sorghum has a new potential insect pest that's been moving up from the south for the last few years. Historically, sorghum has been a more or less a plant-and-forget kind of crop, insect-wise. And there's a couple of pests coming up from the south that radically changes how we manage sorghum. And they're not here yet, but they're on our doorstep last year. So we'll be surveying sorghum. We'll also be conducting surveys in vegetable crops looking for spider mite natural enemies. We have predatory mites in Delaware. Many of them have not been identified. And learning how to identify them and then learning their life cycle is a foundational step to using them to control two-spotted spider mites in a more proactive approach.
Yeah, so a couple of the research projects I'm involved in include slug management in soybeans, and focused largely in soybeans. There are some other projects in corn. Hopefully, by the time this airs, slugs will be in our rearview mirror and we won't be thinking about slugs. But I do think it's worth mentioning because it's pretty cool. So I'm working with a team of entomologists with the University of Delaware in the entomology department, where we're actually going out in the field and, if nothing else, single-handedly collecting slugs and removing the problem one slug at a time from growers' fields. I think to date, we've removed over 2,500 slugs from fields across the state of Delaware. But what we're doing with those slugs is we're actually waiting until they die, which in some cases doesn't seem quick enough, and seeing what emerges from them. And when I say that, I'm talking about nematodes. And so when I say the word nematode, a lot of us probably cringe a little bit because we think about the plant parasitic nematodes. Right. But there are all other nematodes that are not all bad, kind of like good bugs and bad bugs. And there are some nematodes that will actually parasitize slugs, is what we're finding, and potentially kill slugs and could be used in the future as a potential control measure. And so, like I said, to date, I think we've removed over 2,500 slugs. We have found some nematodes that have actually emerged from dead slug bodies. And so that's really promising and exciting. And that project's being funded by the Atlantic Soybean Council. Talking about slugs, there are beneficial insects that eat slugs. Probably the one large one that's gained most of the attention, as well as probably the one that contributes most to slug control, is the carabid beetle. So we do have a Delaware Soybean Board project where we're collecting carabid beetles and seeing, doing some feeding preferences with them based on responses to foliage feeding from slugs and some other things like that are really cool that hopefully in the future will go a long way in slug management. We also have a lot of cover crop projects, again, that we're currently doing that when this airs may be in the past that we may discuss here in a minute. Just a couple other things that kind of be on the radar that we're working with. Cereal leaf beetle management in small grains. We're validating, David and I are trying to validate a model that was developed in the South to determine whether or not we could use our weather data. We have this really nice extensive network of weather stations throughout the state, and use that weather data to predict when peak egg laying as well as larval hatch occur in the state. And if we find the model to fit Delaware's climate, then we can say to all of you out there that, hey, now's the time to really focus your scouting effort for cereal leaf beetle management in small grains. So rather than what I currently do today and what we have to say today is start scouting sometime the end of March and follow all the way through, we can really help focus that scouting effort a little bit, which may help with some in managing cereal leaf beetles. And again, efficacy trials, as I mentioned earlier, we have a number of those planned. And then also our light trap program that's been in existence since sometime in the mid-70s. And so, again, we're going to maintain that this coming year. And that focuses largely on trapping corn earworm, European corn borer, and then our stink bug species, which I know is also another bad word, stink bug. But our stink bug species, and so that's something we're going to maintain with a network of traps throughout the state. We actually start that early May, and we'll continue all the way through until around September 1st with that. And our trap results can be found on the IPM Extension webpage.
Okay.
Another project that we've started working on is evaluating the efficacy of slug baits over time. Right now we're experiencing a lot of heavy rains, and so we've been putting out slug baits in the rain and then bringing them back into the lab after a day, 2 days, a week, and finding out whether or not those baits are still effective on slugs.
Well, you've got the right conditions to test it in the rain, that's for sure.
It's also important to keep in mind that some of our insect pests are favored by hot, dry weather, such as spider mites, and mm-hmm. others, like slugs, are favored by cooler, wet conditions. So
that is true.
No matter how the weather changes, there's always something that will respond to it in a way that we need to be thinking about and alerting folks to be on the lookout for.
One of the things that I wanted a little more detail on in Bill's overview of his projects this year, he mentioned a growing degree day model that he and David are looking to validate for Delmarva in relation to cereal leaf beetle. So I asked them to spend a little time expanding on that a little bit.
We're looking at some degree day models for cereal leaf beetle. This is a pretty important pest of wheat. This year, populations statewide have been very quiet, but it's unusual. Every 2 to 3 years, we get a serious outbreak of cereal leaf beetle. And one of our states to the south developed a model looking at temperature data from January 1st to forecast when cereal leaf beetles will be laying eggs in the field. And this has helped them tighten their scouting window down to 2 weeks or so of this target date. Bill, do you want to elaborate on what we've been seeing and conducting so far statewide?
Yeah, absolutely. So as David mentioned, so the idea is to use our weather data, and we're really fortunate in Delaware that we have DEOS, Delaware Environmental Observing System, which has this really nice network of weather stations throughout the state. And so we're hoping to be able to take advantage of that network of weather stations and have really kind of a small-scale weather data from throughout the entire state and be able to use that to hopefully validate this degree day model that was developed in the South. And so if it fits for us, as David mentioned, instead of us saying, hey, it's getting close time to start looking for cereal leaf beetle eggs and thinking about them, we can really focus those scouting efforts. In the past few years, I do feel as though I've seen an increase in the amount of damage in particular in wheat from cereal leaf beetles, and I think that has a lot to do not really so much as far as cereal leaf beetle management, but actually as far as fungicide and disease management in wheat. And so kind of traditionally, we used to really put a lot of fungicides on, which typically included a prophylactic insecticide that went on at flag leaf timing. And that's now, there's a lot of growers that are pushing that fungicide with the often prophylactic insecticide, pushing that back off into flowering with the idea of maybe having some fusarium head blight or scab suppression. And so what that shift in that timing of when that insecticide could be going out is giving us a window where our small grains are vulnerable to having vulnerable to being damaged from cereal leaf beetles. And now that stage that was once protected when the insecticide and fungicide was going on at flag leaf is now able to be fed on and damaged from cereal leaf beetles, and I think it's one that's flying under the radar. So the idea is to validate this model. If the model fits for us, we can alert growers as to when to focus scouting efforts, alert everyone as to when to really pay attention to their small grains, and hopefully in doing that, reduce the amount of damage from cereal leaf beetle and hopefully reduce that threat of having yield losses due to the larval feeding. If you are someone who scouts fields and really has some good scouting records of wheat and barley fields of cereal leaf beetles, and you'd like to share your data with us to help add to our data set, you know, Dave and I are just two of us, and even though we are running all around looking at small grains for cereal leaf beetles, the more data we have, the stronger our data set will be, and the easier it will be for us to draw some conclusions from that as to whether or not the model fits. So if that's something that you would be like to share and help us with cereal leaf beetle science, we're of course would welcome that data, and you can get a hold of us, and we'd be very excited including that in our data set. David mentioned earlier the soybean board project that we're doing where we're surveying soybeans. Probably the other pest that I do want to make sure we mention, or maybe the two pests that are some of our invasive species. The one is the kudzu bug. So that's one that we're going to continue to keep an eye on, keep a lookout for. Last year I did detect it in Newcastle County, Delaware. just south of Newark. It was on kudzu. I found several adults on a kudzu patch. So that is something that we're going to be watching closely as well. And to my knowledge, that's the furthest north that the kudzu bug has been officially detected. So luckily, we haven't found any populations in soybeans that have been a concern at all. And we did actually detect the kudzu bug in Delaware back in 2013 in Sussex County. And again, we're watching fields down there as well, making sure they don't start showing up in soybeans. So that's just something to kind of keep on your radar, and something that Dave and I are going to be also keeping an eye on all summer. So if it does at some point become a problem for us, we're right there ready to alert growers to be on the lookout for the kudzu bug. Another invasive insect that we've talked about a lot over the years, and people are probably tired of hearing about, is the brown marmorated stink bug, BMSB, as we refer to it as. Something else Dave and I are doing this year is that we're actually partnering with our USDA beneficial insect folks. They're actually right here in Newark, Delaware, out on the Newark farm. They have a laboratory there, and we're going to be working with them to release a parasitoid. It's a tiny little wasp. It's not going to sting you. It's just a little tiny wasp that actually parasitizes brown marmorated stink bug eggs. And so this is a form of biological control. And so we're going to be working with USDA to identify and help with the release of this biocontrol agent, this parasitic wasp, to help reduce and control brown marmorated stink bug throughout the state of Delaware. So that's something else that's actually pretty exciting. And so we're really excited and looking forward to doing that as well. We didn't talk a whole lot today about cover crops. We do have a lot of effort in the state on many levels in cover crops. Some stuff that I'm doing that I'm really excited about is looking at what other benefits we can get from our cover crops. When I talk about benefits, I'm really thinking slug management. Again, going back to slugs, I'm trying to see if we can change the way that we're managing our cover crops to benefit us for slugs as it relates to corn and soybeans. And so throughout the state of Delaware this year, we have a number of planting green demonstrations where we're comparing the levels of slug damage on corn and soybeans when we either plant green or plant into a dead cover crop. And so the idea behind that is that in planting green, the slugs will not that your cash crop, your corn or your soybeans, is not the only green food source available to the slugs, that they can also hopefully eat some of the cover crop as well as some of your corn or your soybeans, but reduce some of that pressure off corn and beans as those plants are emerging. And then the other thing is that's potentially building a green bridge, planting into that green cover crop. It's supporting other insects that are feeding on the cover crop, which in turn supports our predators, such as the crabbed beetle I mentioned earlier. And so rather than starving those out, hopefully keeping those populations of beneficial insects high so they're there when our plants are emerging and when we need them. So that's some other work that we're doing in cover crops, as well as looking at whether or not slugs have feeding preferences over different species of cover crops. And the idea behind that is to be able to say, hey, slugs really like cereal rye. That's based off some work that was done up in Pennsylvania by Dr. John Tooker. Slugs really like cereal rye. So maybe in the end of the day, we can say, hey, if your field has a history of slug problem, you may not want to plant cereal rye as a cover crop because you're giving them exactly what they want. Instead, you might want to plant a cover crop species that they don't like. And so maybe they won't be as fit in the spring. They won't be as healthy. You won't have as many slugs in your fields. And then alternatively, the other idea behind that is that understanding that if slugs have a preference for one species of cover crop, maybe you plant that species of cover crop and then plant green into that. So again, the slugs are maybe, hey, I really like cereal rye. I'm going to eat cereal rye instead of eating all of your corn and soybeans, or maybe I'm going to eat some cereal rye and not as much of as many of your corn and soybean plants. So that's some other work that we're doing to stay tuned for and kind of pay attention to that's going on in the state. And there's others involved in these projects as well. That's just kind of as it relates to really slug management and insect management in general.
I'm glad you added those projects too, because I know the slug question always comes up when we talk about cover crops. And so people who are resistant to using tillage to control slugs, you know, they're definitely looking forward to some more information and alternatives about how you can manage and minimize that damage. And it sounds like with the planting green and figuring out food preferences and stuff, one of the ways that that's controlling damage is just because it's kind of spreading it out over more area, you know, so like they'll still eat corn and soybeans, but they'll, because they're also eating on the cover crop, like the damage to your cash crop is less maybe than it would have been if they were focused solely on that crop. Does that seem right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is not going to solve our slug problems completely, but in a lot of cases, all we need is that little bit of extra help until the sun comes out, until it stops raining and the sun comes out and it gets warm. And then our corn and our soybeans can take off and grow quickly. And so sometimes all we need is that little bit of an edge. And so that's the idea. It doesn't mean if you plant green into a cover crop, you're not going to have slug problems, because you are. You will see slug damaged plants. The work that we've already done this year, I've seen plenty of slug damage where we planted green. But sometimes it may give us just that little bit of extra help to keep us from losing our stands and having to replant. And that's kind of the idea behind it. You know, this approach is not it's not going to completely solve our problem. But again, this as well as maybe some other things in time can help us enough that slugs will become less of a problem for us. That's the hope.
Gotcha.
The other thing I want to add about planting green is that it can help with weed management. It helps provide shade to the soil surface and habitat for insects that feed on weed seeds. At the same time, there are insects that respond to that green cover crop favorably. So the other angle that we're looking at is what are the general insect pest pressure in those green cover crops and then on the cash crop as they're sowed in. So we can get a handle of if a grower wants to pursue this, how will it influence his slug management? How might it influence some of his early season seedling pests that respond to cover crops? Well, as Bill mentioned, we are interested in invasive pests. In soybeans, we're looking at kudzu bug. We look at brown marmorated stink bug in a number of crops and the natural enemies associated with both. A third pest that is on our doorstep in Delaware is the spotted lanternfly. Delaware Department of Ag intercepted a specimen of this insect in Newcastle County in November of 2017. This insect was introduced into Pennsylvania around 2014. It's a beautiful insect. It's about an inch long as an adult. It's got these pink and black spots on its wings. Its hind wings are blazing red. And this is a potentially a very severe agricultural pest, especially on fruit crops, grapes, apples, but it's also been seen on some vegetables. It's been seen in cucumbers. It's been seen in herbs like horseradish that generally we don't think of having any sort of insect pressure. This insect is building up in very large numbers. It feeds on plant sap, and it will stick its needle-like mouth into the bark of a tree or the stem of a woody plant, and it sucks the sap out, trying to get protein. Well, the insect is feeding on probably the most protein-poor part of a plant, so it has to handle a lot of sap. And it basically excretes sugar water. The insect is a tremendous hitchhiker. It lays its eggs on a number of surfaces, on tree bark, on equipment, on vehicles. And so it's only a matter of time before it arrives. So Delaware Department of Ag is looking for it. If you do see this insect, please report it to Delaware Department of Ag. We are trying to slow its spread, hopefully enough so that by the time that natural enemies from its native range in Southeast Asia can be identified, imported, and used to bring their populations back into a balance. One research area that we will be looking at moving forward is conducting a variety of sentinel plots. These sentinel plots are spread throughout the Mid-Atlantic for monitoring corn earworm resistance and insect resistance in general to some of our BT traits. And we're also looking at conducting sentinel plots throughout the state on various agricultural commodities to demonstrate IPM and where IPM fits versus an automatic insecticide application because the calendar hits a magic date without any particular right. known pest presence. So that's something that we will be developing and pushing for in the near future.
This episode of From Cloud to Cab is made possible through the support of the Harry R. Hughes Center for Agroecology and the Sussex Conservation District.